Here we go.
All right. My name is Emily Nussbaum, and I'm here with Alice Wong, talking with her this evening for the qualitative research SIG of AERA. And I am super thrilled to be interviewing Alice for this episode. Alice is the director of the Disability Visibility Project, a thought leader known everywhere in disability justice and access issues, and author of the recently published acclaimed book, Disability Visibility. So, Alice, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me, Emily. And, you know, I also want to say that we have been friends and have known each other for a long time. And I just delighted to be in conversation with you.
Yeah, me too. So since this is for a group focused on qualitative inquiry, I reached out to you thinking about your work through various forms of social media and the Disability Visibility Project and ways that the qualitative research community can start to think more expansively about what counts as qualitative research and that kind of thing. But I think if I'm correct, and clarify, of course, that you began a more academic career in sociology.
Yes, I did.
So I wondered if you could just give us kind of that background of how you started thinking about research and what that background was. And then we can talk more about the shift you made to the super important and impactful work that you're doing now.
Well, I guess, long story short, my initial career goals and ambitions was to be in academia. I loved sociology ever since the high school class. And, you know, I feel like sociology gave me the lens to really see the world, analyze the world, especially, you know, when thinking about disability, you know, beyond, you know, the antiquated, very limited medical model.
Right.
So, you know, I went to undergrad, I double majored in English and sociology. And, you know, I came in contact with some really wonderful professors in the sociology department at Indiana University in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. And they were really the ones who gave me my first experience as, you know, a research assistant. And, you know, to tell you the truth, I am so grateful for their support and their belief in me as a young student. And it really, you know, activated me. You know, I saw a lot of, you know, gaps in the literature. And, you know, just gaps in research, just, you know, where are the disabled people? You know, there's so much, you know.
Like in terms of when you talk about gaps and disabled people in terms of voice and in terms of like representation outside kind of more deficit based perspectives.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we kind of talked about like healthcare, for example. You know, there's a lot of work on healthcare inequalities and the social construction of medicine. But, you know, also made me think a lot about, like, well, what about, you know, disability? And there's, you know, a lot of work on devious and a lot of work on stigma. You know, Irving Goffman was, one of the earliest kind of people, Goffman and Foucault as well, just really, you know, made me think about what are the disabled perspectives, disabled kind of scholarship that will advance these kinds of ideas, to extend these ideas.
Right.
And it wasn't until, you know, that's really when I started learning about disability studies.
Okay.
The work of Irvi Kaysola, Lewis.
Uh-huh.
You know, his work, people from the UK, such as Mike Oliver.
Mm-hmm.
Here's just some of that early.
Some of the early social model.
Yeah, just, you know, those were kind of like, wow, like, there are these, you know, there are people doing this work. And, you know, I thought this could be my contribution. I think one person in particular that's really was kind of a model of what I think I wanted to do was the late Barbara Faye Waxman Fiducia.
Yeah, I just need to share, if you can share a little bit about who she is. I only just learned about her and her work recently in the last few months, helping a longtime activist sort of organize some of their materials for an archive for the San Francisco Public Library. And amazing, amazing. So do you want to just mention who Barbara Waxman is?
Yeah. So Barbara Faye Waxman Fiducia is a disabled woman who is both a scholar and an activist.
Mm-hmm.
And she's no longer with us, you know, rest in power to Barbara. And, you know, she was one of these so, like, unapologetic, badass disabled women who just
mm-hmm.
were totally grounded in the love of her body, the love of her sexuality. I mean, she did a lot of work on reproductive and sexual health of disabled women, and that was initially one of the areas that I really wanted to focus on. And I was like, you know, as I did kind of various reviews as a undergrad, you know, just searching. You know, just so
yeah,
looking for any bits of people that are out there that I could kind of connect with, or at least identify with.
Right, right, right.
So, you know, I think Barbara was one of those people, and, you know, she had a really long career of being both a scholar and an activist. Like, she did both. She did.
Yeah.
And they both, you know, were hand in hand.
Yeah, I'm interested in that. And I want to get back to more of your work or how you're thinking about it. But this nexus of being a scholar and an activist and what more traditional kind of thinkers or people who are in more traditional academic spaces, what we could take away from that, or what any of those people could take away from that. Because I think that that nexus is very, very important when we think about advancing the critical aims of qualitative research.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, people like Barbara and the late Paul K. Longmore, who's a historian and academic, and also a really, you know, both activists. This says a lot about, I think, the academy and, you know, marginalized people, you know, who are entering the academy. They can't separate their lived experiences
right.
from their research, from the way they teach, from
right.
the way
correct
they relate to students, faculty, and staff. I think, you know, what academia does clearly is centers sort of normative body minds, clearly, you know, white perspectives, white dorms. And, you know, this places a lot of undue pressure to force people to, like, separate parts of themselves, you know, to not.
Mm-hmm.
It does not encourage people to bring everything that they are.
Yeah, yeah.
In academic spaces. I mean, if we think about the way scholars of color are really just, you know, not welcomed, and, you know, so many marginalized students and emerging scholars interact with those spaces, but they often don't end up staying.
Right.
This says a lot about the structural racism and ableism and class system that is pretty much, you know, permeated throughout the academy.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think sometimes people ask me, like, when did I become an activist? You know, I usually say, like, and this is a very kind of simplistic answer, but, you know, being disabled in a non-disabled world did not give me a choice.
Of course.
Like, this was not a privilege. I had to choose to opt in, you know, because, you know, of ableism. And I think, you know, a lot of what I admired in both Paul and Barbara is that they used their positions, they used the research, they used all of their expertise and skills to also serve us as the disability community. And I think that to me was like, it shouldn't be a radical notion, but I think it still is, because it goes against every sort of conventional wisdom on, you know, getting tenure or being professional, quote unquote.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is what, you know, I think so many people have different motives of why they are a scholar. And I think for myself, you know, additionally, I wanted to contribute to the field. I, you know, thought by perspective, by, I would like to be somebody that does research as a disabled person with disabled people versus about or at disabled people.
Yeah. That's a huge distinction. I want to just, can I just pause for 1 second and reinforce that to people that are listening? Like, that kind of distinction is really the crux of, say, the academic field of disability studies, and then also the way community scholars are working around and with and in disability, right? Which is, research isn't about or on or to fix or anything like that for disabled people, right? But it's about centering disabled people and non-normative body minds and thinking of disabled people as research partners as well in the process. So turning inside out of the framework.
Yes. And I think that we, you know, I think also I want to share that, you know, lived experience in addition to other skills, they're not mutually exclusive, right?
Yeah.
I think this is,
right.
This is a big, I think, misconception or binary that's I want to smash, because I think people presume that academics have the research skills and methods and theory and all that stuff, and disabled people are the ones who are feeding the ideas or
that's really,
you know, giving the feedback versus active partners in the development of theory.
Yeah, so that's super powerful, Alice.
It is, should be obvious, but it's not.
I can.
And I think, there's still a lot of power dynamics that,
of course,
and the, you know, disabled people are treated, I think, in very tokenistic, exploitative, and extractive ways.
Yeah. And especially when we think of multiply marginalized disabled people.
Yes.
Absolutely so.
The Qualitative Research Special Interest Group was established in 1987 to create a space within the American Educational Research Association for the discussion of ethical, philosophical, and methodological issues in qualitative research. We invite you to consider joining the Qualitative Research SIG today. For members of AERA, the annual fee for joining the Qualitative Research Special Interest Group for regular non-graduate student members is $10, and the annual fee for graduate students is $5. As members of the QRSIG, you will gain access to a network of fellow qualitative scholars, as well as our many activities, ranging from mentoring opportunities to our podcast series to updates and news related to recent qualitative publications and jobs. Please visit the American Educational Research Association's website at www.aera.net to join the Qualitative Research SIG today.
So I'm curious, because I think this is this notion, I mean, I wrote it down and I'll just say it again, that is so powerful. This notion of lived experience versus academic skills are not mutually exclusive, mm-hmm. right? And it's like this question of who gets to make knowledge, right? Like mm-hmm. it's a question of epistemology, really, and who gets to create knowledge. And so it makes me think about why I wanted to reach out to you to do this interview, thinking about your work in the public domain, right? You have a very strong social media presence, of course, and can speak about different, like on Twitter with Crip the Vote, but also thinking about the Disability Visibility Project and the way your kind of work in those areas can help academics, you know, people who are in academic spaces really think more expansively about this idea of knowledge production. So do you mind sharing with us a little bit about the Disability Visibility Project, sort of how it emerged, what it is, and we can go from there?
Yeah, sure thing. I think before I kind of go into that response, I want to also say, you know, I think who gets to form the research questions? Yeah, I think that's really central in terms of just framing everything. You know, not just who gets to create knowledge, but who really gets to ask the question. Because
even the step before that, right?
And I think asking the question is really about identifying something that's a phenomenon. Yeah. And I feel like, you know, what we need more in all disciplines in academia is more people with, you know, a variety of, you know, perspectives, but also located in different places, right? Different contexts. Yeah. And I think,
yeah,
you know, if we don't even use the term research questions, you know, I know that disabled people ask a lot of amazing questions all the time.
Of course.
And that this is actually such rich, you know.
Absolutely.
Rich kind of intellectual work.
Yeah.
But it's not. But the thing is that it doesn't take place within certain structures. So it's not recognized as intellectual work. So I think, you know, we need to also kind of unpack all of that stuff about, you know, framing research, asking the questions, producing the knowledge, because, again, it's often those who do have those means of production are the ones driving the questions. And it should really be in the hands of those who are the focus of inquiry, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that brings up, like, I know, like, I asked a previous question that brought this up, but this then even brings up this notion of, like, I mean, I think a lot about this and some of the partnerships I have with community scholars about, like, what do we then do with, like, with those questions and what comes out of them, right? And how do we not use it? How do we use it for the purposes of the individuals that have framed the questions, right? Versus the purposes that people in the academy often use them for. But
So I think that's, you know, one thing that's, you know, all of these kind of feelings and thoughts about who is centered, who has control, who has, you know, creative control, right? Just the ability to conceptualize and articulate ideas. You know, that to me is, it doesn't take place in a vacuum, right? Like, clearly, these things happen, you know, in collaboration with others, and often, you know, building on, you know, past work and past ideas. So, you know, there's a lot of what happens, I think that leaves a lot of people out. So, you know, and I feel like as my way of right now is, you know, I'm kind of not limiting myself in terms of inside or outside, you know, the academy. I feel like I could be wherever I want to be. And, you know, I might be just like, I might just have a day pass, you know, into academic spaces. And, you know, that's fine by me because I'm, you know, I like to kind of keep my moment, at a minimum, but also still be engaged. You know, I think that's, to me, what's really exciting, that I don't think of these things as separate. I believe that disabled people belong everywhere.
Yes.
And, you know, while I have clearly, I guess, to be honest, I mean, I do think I've been driven out of academia for a lot of reasons, but I don't regret it. You know, I think it was probably the smartest decision I ever made, to be honest.
Okay.
So, So the Disability Project.
And I just want to, can I offer before you start, like, I just want to say that this project and thinking about this project as research is, to me, so transformative and powerful. And when we think about wanting to, you know, you're a part of an upcoming book project, that I have with another colleague, and our purpose is in this edited volume to, I think we called it, quote, radical possibilities, maybe. I can't quite remember, but thinking about how something like the Disability Visibility Project can allow us to think so much more expansively, right, about this question of what counts, right? So I just wanted to give that intro of why, of the super important connection, I think, between the DVP and qualitative research and the qualitative research community.
Well, thank you. And I think, you know, we could use the terms content, media, culture, and research almost, you know, interchangeably. You know, I think it's, whatever you want to call it, it's useful, it's valid, it's significant. So, you know, the reason why I started the DVP was due to my own frustration at, you know, the kind of the history about disabled people by disabled people. You know, I started in 2014. to really additionally ask an oral history campaign, to collect stories by disabled people through a through oral history nonprofit or StoryCorps in the lead up to the 25th anniversary of the ADA. Which is it? Which was in 2015. And I did that as a way to generate and document our stories and to not kind of wait around for a story. You know, I feel like, you know, that to me was one of the most kind of exciting things.
Yeah.
Is to give license and to encourage people to say, like, your story matters.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to be an icon. You don't have to be a leader or famous. You know, your story is part of this growing collective of, like, what is the disability experience like in the 21st century?
Yeah.
And why can't we participate in the creation and documentation of our history? And the fact that StoryCorps has a relationship with the Library of Congress meant that a lot of participants could have their story archived there. And that to me,
it's very powerful.
Was kind of like, you know, this is a gift for academics, for historians, for the public. And that feels powerful.
Yeah.
That feels really good, and it feels like it's something that we're putting out into the world that is for the future.
Yeah.
Which is precisely, I think, so much of the intention of the research, right? That it leads to advancement. It leads
absolutely.
To
like future orientation of
the world. Yeah, so I think that's, to me, that's where the idea started. And, you know, I used, like, I'm just one person, you know, I didn't know, like, I really didn't know.
But your impact is so huge, you know that. I hope you know that.
I mean, I guess, but, yeah, to be honest, like, I just started it, use the tools that I had in front of me, which is, you know, a website, which was social media. And I think, you know, these were the things that I had available to me. And I just, you know, leveraged the shit out of it. And, you know, this snowballed. You know, I thought it would just be it was initially a one-year thing. And I think it's sparked a real interest and a real hunger. That's, you know, people have been wanting ways to tell their stories.
Yeah. And, to create a history and knowledge base that has not existed before.
Yeah, and I think, clearly I didn't want to limit myself to oral histories, which could be, you know, for a lot of perspectives, an honest form that's accessible to, you know, people who are deaf and hard of hearing. So, you know, I branched out and started publishing guest essays on my website. I started a podcast in 2017, which is really amazing because here I am talking to you and December 2020, and we are on, I just published my 92nd episode.
Oh my gosh.
So that's wild to me.
Yeah.
But it's been a real adventure and, you know, a real, just a labor of love to be able to, you know, jump around and try different methods, use different formats, and to communicate to people in multiple ways. And I think that's, you know, for researchers and academics, you know, who have so much, not so much work, you know, let's say you're a qualitative researcher and you just complete a major study or project.
Right.
You know, there's so much, there's so many gems in your work that really needs to reach people. Yeah. And I think, you know, I would hope that academics think beyond their journal articles, beyond their conference presentations, go beyond, you know, a slide deck, you know, just...
Right, yeah.
You know, I want... and I know these things are not rewarded within the system.
Yeah.
And that's also part of the problem.
Sure.
Yeah, there's no, like, incentive to create plain language,
right,
accessible version of your work. But
yeah. Like you're talking about, like, that sort of embedded forms of, like, ableism and racism and classism that exist within the academy and what, you know, traditional researchers are expected to produce.
Yeah, and I get the kind of pressures, you know, like, that people are under, especially junior or junior faculty or, you know, adjunct or graduate students, you know, because you do have to kind of perform and conform up to a certain point, right? This is the reality that I experienced as well. Mm-hmm. And
I think, you know, it's a pretty true reality in most places still.
Yeah, and I think anybody who claims that otherwise is not really being honest, you know, to be honest, to be real.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think, you know, this is a real reflection point where, you know, we're in a current political and cultural climate where people and institutions are being held accountable.
Yeah.
And this is the time, if not now, to really think about what are your intentions? How do you practice your values?
Yeah.
Not just in your work life, but in your everyday life.
Sure.
Well, like, if you say you're an ally or that you're in solidarity with others, where does that show up? Like, what are the ways that you're actually doing this? And I think, you know, one of the ways, you know, academics could, you know, to be more accountable is...
share with us.
You know, put your work out there and to really receive the critique, to receive, you know, real questions by the people that are the most impacted. You know, I think to not receive that in a defensive way.
Absolutely. And going beyond, like, you know, in a qualitative research class or in most textbooks, there's something called a member check where you run your analysis by the people that participated. But I think what you're talking about speaks so much more deeply about the relational ways that researchers and participants or co-researchers are engaging and allowing those who have more privilege and power to be asked really difficult questions. Thinking far beyond what gets talked about, I think, in the typical course, qualitative research course or text.
It's not a checklist, right? It's not a checklist, please. Must be more, I think, more thoughtful.
Yeah.
More intentional.
Yeah.
And also just acknowledge like what your own kind of weaknesses or areas that you're just not as well versed in. I think, you know, there's also this very weird, you know, I think expectation that, you know, researchers and like, you know, scholars have to like know it all. And I think that often is a unfair kind of expectation. And I think it goes a long way when I see scholars who are just really open and just say what they know and what they don't know, admitting that we all have biases.
Yes.
And that, let's face it, like, research and the things we create are never, ever neutral.
Never.
If we can all start from that place,
yeah,
I feel like that's where you can really start having really authentic relationships with people from the outside. As I mentioned, you know, there's all this kind of invisible labor that's never going to be compensated by the Academy. And I think one other activity that's really undervalued and really not encouraged is relationship building.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I feel like that's
agreed.
Something that for those of you know, listening, it doesn't happen overnight. You know, like, say you have a study, you're getting IRB approval right now. And you're like, oh shit, like, I better, you know, do community outreach. You can't rush this stuff. And people will sense that you're doing this not with the right intentions.
Yeah.
So you have to lay the groundwork. And you have to be of service to others.
Yeah.
And be really transparent to be able to build relationships with people, whether they end up being participants in your study or as co-creators.
Absolutely.
So there's just a lot of, you know, very kind of foundational work that requires a lot of your own labor. But I will say that this is something that is absolutely valuable. And it's going to really enrich and expand.
Yeah. I mean, it's essential, I think, when we're talking about the kind of research that you're promoting.
Yeah. It's going to serve you as well in the long run, but it's really going to serve everyone. And I think that's, you know, that's kind of the crux.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, Alice, thank you so much for sharing. I feel like if I didn't try to wrap us up, I could stay on here with you chatting about different things for a really long time. But I want to be respectful of your time. And I know that everyone who's listening is so appreciative to hearing your perspective. So thank you so much for sharing your work and your thinking and your prompts for sort of the academic community of qualitative researchers is super important.
Thanks, Emily. And also, before we end, I was wondering if I could, you know, prompt some more questions.
Oh, sure. Of course. So, yeah. Absolutely.
So this is from a book chapter for a book that you are co-editing.
Oh,
so I'm gonna for people who might not ever read this or come across this book chapter that I wrote for Emily and Dr. Lester. Here are just some of my thoughts and questions for qualitative researchers. Number one, how are you uplifting and amplifying the scholarship of people outside of the academy, such as inviting them to speak at your classes, being on a panel, co-presenting at meetings, and co-authoring and designing research projects and papers? Here's another question. How many non-academic scholars do you cite in your work? And if you can't name any, why is that?
Oh gosh, that's so important. Very, very, very important. Huge, huge question.
And two more questions. If you're conducting research about a marginalized community, how will you solicit feedback and critique from people with this experience? And the final question, which I think is probably the thorniest question, it can actually be an entire separate podcast episode, but I'll leave people with this one. Before diving into research about a marginalized community, ask yourself if you are the best person to do this.
Oh.
And whether it's appropriate to partner or refer other scholars who have been doing the work. Right. So that is a big question, but I think
here's one.
I leave the listeners hopefully with a lot of food for thought.
Yeah, of course, of course. Thank you so much, Alice Wong.